and her heartbeat. She had to find the stillness in her body and in her soul. She focused her mind on her heart and brought it down slower and slower until it was beating just once every few seconds. The fawn's little white tail twitched nervously as she slowly made her way closer, her skinny little body suspended on her tremulous, overly long legs and her dainty black hooves. The fawn came very close, studied Willa for several seconds, then folded her legs and curled up into a little spotted ball in the place between Willa's folded legs and her chest. Willa felt the soft warmth of the fawn's silky fur against her skin, the minute movement of the fawn's gentle breaths, and the beat of her tiny heart. Willa slowly let the blood begin to flow through her heart again until her heartbeat matched the fawn's. While the mother deer fed on the nearby grass and watched over them, Willa and the fawn fell quietly asleep. When Willa woke in the middle of the night, the mother deer was still feeding a short distance away, as if grateful to have a few moments on her own while she knew her fawn was safe. Willa, without disturbing the fawn, slowly reached out and grasped some of the fine, thin grass at the edge of the stream. It tasted wet and sweet in her mouth. The presence of the mother deer feeding nearby and the little sleeping fawn in the bend of her body felt like a salve to her hidden wounds, as if one of the leaves from her mamma's little tree had begun to touch her soul. As she lay there in the darkness, she noticed a tiny point of glowing blue light hovering a few inches off the ground on the other side of the stream. Just as she turned toward it, it went dark and disappeared. She thought she must have imagined it, but then another blue light appeared a few feet away from her, and then another farther out in the trees. A moment later, hundreds of tiny blue lights lit up the darkness around her, gliding slowly a few inches off the ground on both sides of the stream and all through the forest, setting the nighttime world aglow with steady, soft blue light. Despite the sadness in her heart, Willa smiled. They were the blue ghost fireflies that her mamma had shown her and Aliu years before. They were some of the rarest creatures in the world. These beautiful blue spirits appeared only in certain glens hidden deep in the forest on particular mountains, and only for a few moments on a few nights each year. It was as if her mamma had brought them out tonight just for her, to remind her of who she had been and who she still remained. And now, as Willa sat alone with the blue ghosts floating gently around her, their wandering lines of soft, glowing light became a dance, with the humming of the forest insects and the babbling of the stream their music, and her heart filling with awe. She slowly came to the realization that despite everything that had happened in her life, the forest wasn't dead. The forest was still alive. And she was alive within it, her heart still beating. She knew that she had betrayed her clan, and she had betrayed the Padawan. But more than that, she realized, he had betrayed her. She didn't understand who or what the Padawan was, or how he became the god of the clan, but he had betrayed the... What had he betrayed? The Farron ways? But what were those ways in a world that moved like a river changing from season to season, storm to storm? She didn't know. What she did know was that he had betrayed her. Her ways. Her heart. He had trapped and killed the animals of the forest. He had captured and imprisoned humans. He had sent his yaders to kill her mamma, to silence the last of the ancient whisperers. Willa looked around her at the forest. She had followed the Padawan loyally all her life. She had idolized him, struggled for him, stole for him, all for him, all for the clan. There is no I, only we. But deep down, what kind of Farron was he? What kind of Farron could do these things that he had done? She didn't know. What she wondered now was what kind of Farron she was going to become. She slowly climbed up onto her feet. She looked down the path of the stream as it meandered between the trunks of the great trees and disappeared in the distance. She gazed at the blue glowing mist curling through the branches that reached toward the sky. And then she looked up toward the slope of the mountain. The forests of the Great Smoky Mountain, she thought. The breath of life. My life. My grandmother's life. Food and water. Light and darkness. The trees, the animals, the flow of the river, the cut of the rocks, and all the world around me. The Padawan had said that she would be cast out into the world on her own, and that she could not survive. But she could survive. She knew how to forage for food. She knew the ways of the forest animals. She knew the spirit of the world. I'll live like the Farron of old. And maybe there were other places she could go, places she'd never been before, places she couldn't even imagine. And maybe there were other people out here. Maybe there were other clans, places she could find warmth and shelter when winter came. Standing there in the forest on her own, she didn't feel strong, and she didn't feel happy. But she finally felt as if she could go on. She said farewell to the little fawn and the mother deer, and she started walking. She wasn't sure it was even possible, but she decided that she was going to try to climb to the top of the great mountain and look out at the world in which she lived. Chapter 30. She didn't know exactly why she was doing it. She just wanted to climb, to feel the motion of it in her body. It was an easy walk up the forested slope at first, eating the red berries of the mountain ash along the way. Then it became much rockier and steeper, and the difficulty of it drove her to keep going. The muscles in her arms and legs burned. The cold mountain air pushed through her lungs. As she pulled herself up the side of the mountain, the sharpness of the jagged rock tore at the bare skin of her hands. She didn't know why, but she liked the sharp, tangible, physical pain of it. The blowing wind pulled tears from her eyes. Where the ground became too steep, she grabbed the roots and branches of the rhododendron like they were the rungs of a homesteader's ladder. When she spotted blackberries growing in the mountainside thickets, she stuffed some in her mouth. She drank from the little rivulets of water that dripped down the crevices of the rock past profusions of lush ferns. With its steep, rocky slopes, the mountain had always told people that it didn't want to be climbed. But she couldn't help but think that today it was providing for her along the way. She followed the rocky stream beds that snaked up between the spurs of the mountain, up through the boulders and the old, weathered trees torn and twisted by the wind. She climbed hand over hand, up through the silent, craggy stone of ancient times. Her heart worked painfully in her chest. Her lungs dragged for air. But she kept going. She wanted nothing now but for the pain in her body and the loneliness in her soul to block out what lay behind her. She came into an area of thick fog where the great mountain often hid its head when it was sleeping, its dreaming mists floating across its smoky peak. But then she realized that it wasn't just the normal fog she was used to down in Dead Hollow and the valleys below. She was so high up that she was actually inside a cloud as it moved across the sky. She felt the cool touch of the cloud's tiny droplets on her cheeks as she climbed, and she tasted the sweetness of it on her tongue. Way up in the sky now, the air had chilled, but her body was sweating despite the cold. Her muscles ached. Her fingers bled. Blisters pained her feet. But she kept climbing, pushing, driving her mamma's death from her body. Reaching and grabbing and pulling and climbing, up and up and up she went. She wanted to get to the top of the mountain and see the entirety of the world. And then, suddenly, there was nothing more to grab. She was surrounded by a dense stand of giant fir trees, with trunks thicker than her outstretched arms. But there was no higher ground. She frowned in confusion. At first, she thought she must have veered off course and reached a false peak, and that the real mountain was still above her, for the mountain had always been above her. But then she realized where she was. She had done it. She had reached the peak of the great mountain for the first time in her life. Unable to see through the foliage around her, she went over to the thickest and tallest of the giant fir trees. She felt unusually nervous about approaching it. With her mamma gone from the world, did her own powers still work? Could she still speak to the trees? Would they still listen? Could she still learn and grow without her teacher? Or had all the magic of the world disappeared? "I'm hoping you can help me get a little higher, my friend," she said softly in the old language, and she started climbing. Her small, clawed fingers and her gripping toes clung easily to the rough bark of the colossal tree as she climbed, almost as if the two of them, she and this age-old tree, had grown up to be part of one another's lives. When she struggled or almost lost her grip, the tree lifted a branch or intertwined a vine around her hand to help her. She climbed and climbed, reaching for one branch after another, up and up through the mist-dripping boughs of the tree, until she came to the highest branches, her body finally swaying gently in the breeze. She looked out from her eagle perch with excitement, but all she could see was the gray mist of the clouds rolling all around her. She was surrounded by them, inside them. But the clouds weren't just sitting still, blocking her sight. They were changing, rolling and turning, opening and closing the space around her, as if the great mountain was saying, "Just wait a moment, and I will show you." As the clouds began to clear, she spotted a patch of sky and the gleam of sunlight. She caught a glimpse of a forested ridge not too far away, and then a peak a little farther out. And then, as the clouds opened up, she began to see a vast world of rolling green mountains and shadowed valleys. Golden rays poured through the openings in the clouds and cast their light across the land. She turned one way and then another, gazing out at the world. Mountain ranges in every direction for as far as she could see. The forested slopes of the closest mountains lay around her with the evergreen canopy of the trees. The mountain ridges farther on were darker green in color, and the ones beyond those a deep blue, and beyond those a lighter blue. Mountains so far away that they seemed to turn into the sky. Layer upon layer of mountains, each one's shade of green and blue blending into the next, hundreds of colors for which humans had no names. It was the most beautiful thing she had ever seen. She squinted her eyes and looked out toward the edge of the world, but beyond the distant mountains, all she could see were more mountains. Then she remembered something that had happened the year before. She had been creeping through the forest near Cade's Cove, a quiet valley where a community of homesteaders lived, when she overheard two dayfolk men talking as oxen pulled their carriage down the road.
"Well, you know," one of the men had said, Back in the olden days, them folk reckoned the earth was flat.
I can't see how they thought that, said his friend. Even back then, I reckon they knew the earth was round. Look at the shadow cast on the moon.
But standing on top of the great mountain at this moment, Willen knew that the Dayfolk men were wrong. The earth was neither flat nor round. It was mountains. It was jagged rocks and steep ravines, treeless windy ridges and shaded wooded glens, streams winding through hidden forest realms, and high, rounded peaks that looked out across the world. And there, too, only mountains. How could it be any other way? She thought. How could the trees and the mountains ever end? It would cease to be the world. She remembered floating through the underworld of Dead Hollow, thinking about the Padoran, about the way of the Farron and what that meant. The Farron ways and the human ways. The us and the them. The we and the I. Maybe there wasn't just one way, but many. The earth wasn't flat or round. It was mountains. As she gazed across the sky, she spotted something out of the corner of her eye and turned toward it. It was just a speck at first, very distant, but as it came closer, she soon realized that it was a hawk, soaring on the currents of air that flowed like rivers above the ridges of the mountains. With the gentle tilt of its wings, the hawk steered its way through the sky. It was coming very close, and then her heart leapt a little when it glided right past her. For the first time in her life, she wasn't looking up at a hawk, but down at it. And as the hawk flew by, it tilted its head and looked up at her, as if surprised to see her there up on top of the world. As the hawk soared on and looked back out across his aerial domain, she wondered again about what the men had said about the shape of the earth. The hawk knows, she thought. He knows the air. He knows the earth. He can see it all up here. She gazed out across the mountainous world, trying to imagine what was out there, trying to imagine where she could go. As the mist began to slowly roll back in, it was as if the mountain was gently saying, "You've had enough now, little one. It's time for you to go." She knew the mountain was used to living in the mist and only seldom showed its true self, and she was grateful that it had decided to show itself to her. As the incoming clouds formed along the ridges, she watched the mist roll down the sides of the great mountain into the valleys below. She thought about all the living creatures down there, the wolves in their dens and the bears by the lake, the mother deer and her fawn, the Farron in their twisted lair, and the Cherokee tending their farms, and the homesteaders in their log cabins, and the newcomers with their iron machines. All coming together, the mist of the mountain, the breath of their world, providing life to them all. An unusual scent touched her nostrils. Frowning, she sniffed the air, and then turned and scanned. She wished she could ask the hawk what he could see, because she knew his eyes were far better than her own, but he was long on his way. Then she spotted what looked like a thin line of gray mist floating up from a particular spot in the distance. But it wasn't mist. It was a trail of smoke rising from one of the valleys far below her. She knew that particular valley well, with its coves of giant hemlocks, towering pines, and black walnut trees, old friends who had shaded her from the summer sun while they listened to her singing her Farron songs of old. She knew it must be a great outpouring of smoke for her to be able to see it from this distance. It was too much smoke to be the stone-steep breath of a Dayfolk lair, and too narrow to be the fire that consumes the world. A tight and sickening feeling crept slowly into her chest as she stared toward the mysterious smoke. A bright flash lit the spot. An area of trees disintegrated, and the trees around it collapsed to the ground, one after the other, like they were being eaten by a giant beast. A great eruption of smoke and debris rose up into the air. And then the sound of it hit her in the chest, like a crack of thunder after a bolt of lightning. The booming sound flew across the sky and echoed off the mountains behind her. A thick plume of black smoke rose up from where the trees had been destroyed. Even from this great distance, she could hear their screaming, their twisting, burning cries as their ancient spirits came crashing to the ground. "Anna Kanasha," she cried out in anguish, her heart aching for the wounded and murdered trees, and all the birds and animals that lived among them. The pain welled up in her chest so quickly and with such powerful force that it sucked her breath away. The tears burned in her eyes as she gazed toward the devastation. What vicious force had caused such terrible destruction? Chapter 31. Willow ran across the rocky terrain, leaping from one jagged edge to the next, diving headlong through thickets of underbrush, and sprinting through the groves of the tall, growing trees, pushed on by the desperate hope that she might be able to help some of the animals that had been hurt by the destruction she'd seen from the mountaintop. But she had miles to go. She knew that her camouflage wouldn't protect her when she was traversing long distances like this. An onlooker would see a flash of movement and a blur of color as her skin changed from one rocky gray or leafy green texture to the next. It would leave her vulnerable to attack, but she had to find out what had happened. Exhausted from running, she slowed to catch her breath when she reached Moss Hollow, a deep ravine dark with the green shadows of its protecting trees, where thin runnels of water trickled through the mossy rocks and gathered into a stream. It was the place where the valley's river was forever being born. After taking a quick drink, she continued on. She followed the winding path of the young river until she arrived at the Three Forks, where several streams came together to become a true and powerful river with a life and soul of its own. From here, she ran along the rocky bank as the great river began finding its own way and making its own decisions, moving boulders and carving through the earth, getting stronger and deeper as all the streams around it joined its cause, mile after mile, winding through the forest until it was strong and unstoppable, wearing down the mountains through which it flowed. She had seen with her eyes and learned in her soul that where a river is born, the earth shapes its path. But where the river grows up, it begins, in turn, to shape the earth. When she finally reached the area where she had seen the destruction, she split off from the river and headed west into the forest. The sound of many footsteps scuffling through the leaves touched her ears. Then came the hushed whispers of muffled voices. A group of humans was coming her way. She ducked down into the bushes to hide. A dozen Cherokee families were moving quickly and quietly through the forest. They were breathing heavily, their simple cotton clothing soiled and disheveled, and their faces tense with white-eyed fear as they glanced repeatedly behind them. Many of the Cherokee carried sacks and other supplies slung over their shoulders, as if they had hurriedly gathered their belongings from their homes and fled. One woman carried her baby wrapped in a blanket on her back. The men were bleeding from recent wounds, and their faces were smudged with black marks. She had often seen Cherokee walking on the gravel roads that connected the area's towns, and she'd seen them trading peacefully with the homesteaders, but she'd never seen them running through the underbrush like this before. They seemed to be fleeing some sort of danger, but they were also scanning ahead and looking all around as if they were searching for something they had lost. Then she noticed that other than the one baby on the mother's back, there didn't appear to be any other children among them. Was that what they were looking for? Had they lost children? And then, at the rear of the group,
Following behind all the others, she spotted one boy just coming into view. He was a lean, bare-chested boy a few years older than her. He had long black hair and the dark striped markings of his tribe on his face and arms. He definitely wasn't from the same clan as these other Cherokee, but he was carrying one of their girls in his arms, and her hair was matted with blood. He turned and looked into the distance behind him, his face racked with worry. Then he gazed out into the forest, as if hoping to see something there.
"He's not just looking for their enemy," she thought. "He's been separated from someone he loves."
She wondered if this Cherokee boy knew the younger boy that she'd met in the prison beneath the lair, but she didn't think so. There was something very different about this boy. He seemed so strong and fierce of heart, and as he walked across the leaves of the forest, his footsteps made only the slightest, most muffled sound. She could smell the other Cherokee men and women just like she could smell the homesteaders, for they were human beings like any others. She knew it was impossible, but when this odd boy walked past her hiding spot in the bushes, his scent reminded her of something very specific. Mountain lion. At that moment, the boy abruptly stopped, turned, and looked right in her direction. His dark brown eyes scanned the forest intently. Holding her breath, Willa wove herself deeper into the colors and texture of the woods and remained perfectly still. The boy peered into the area she was hiding, like he knew she was there. But she could hold her breath for a long time if she had to. When it came to staying still, no one could outlast her. She had learned patience from the trees. The shock of a booming explosion tore through the forest, rattling the leaves and shaking the ground. Flocks of startled birds flew up. Small animals darted for cover. The ricocheting sound echoed across the walls of the nearby ravines. Willa ducked down with the Cherokee, cowering to the ground, white cold fear surging through her body. She had never felt or heard such a deafening sound, one that slammed through her and everything around her. She was left lying on the ground, her lungs panting and her ears ringing with a high-pitched whine.
"Everybody get up!" the Cherokee boy called to the others. "Keep moving!"
Willa climbed back up onto her feet. Just over the nearest ridge, a large plume of black smoke furled up into the sky. As the small band of Cherokee hurried away in the opposite direction, she went toward the smoke. Chapter 32. As Willa ran through the forest, an eerie gray smoke drifted through the trees. The smell of scorched wood hung in the air, tinged with a sharpness that reminded her of the blast of a killing stick. And then, as she pushed forward through the haze, something even worse invaded her nostrils. The sickening odor of recently cut trees. The overwhelming stench of hacked limbs, severed trunks, and spilled sap filled the air. She came to a ledge where the ground had been broken to pieces by a powerful violence, with loose rocks and dirt crumbling down a cliff at her feet. As she looked out from the edge, a shocking sight opened up before her eyes. The world was gone. A vast area of the forest had been cut down and dragged away. All the trees, for as far as she could see, had been murdered, leaving nothing but a slashed clearing with thousands of stumps in a field of damaged earth, broken branches, and piles of sawdust. Willa cried out at the sight of it. The trees had all been killed. What kind of people would do this? Why would they destroy the forest? There were hundreds of men at work, savaging the trees at the edge of the forest. She watched in horror as two of them pulled a 6-foot-long jagged-edged saw back and forth through a living sugar maple tree, the sharp steel teeth ripping through the flesh of the trunk as sap oozed from the wound. The murderers weren't the homesteaders or the Cherokee that she'd seen from a distance all her life. They were the humans that her mamma and the Padawan had called the newcomers. Now she saw why they had come to her forests.
"Timber!"
the men shouted to their fellow killers as the majestic tree came crashing down to the ground. Then a dozen other men fell upon the tree with axes and hacked away at its limbs. Trees she had known all her life. Tulip poplar, black walnut, white oak, red maple, fell one after the other to the men's saws and axes. A few of these elder souls had lived their lives in these mountain coves for more than 300 years, others for 50 or 100, but all of them were being cut down in a matter of hours. Willa felt a rumbling in the earth beneath her feet, and she heard a loud rushing sound. She turned to see a giant black machine rolling on long steel rails that the men had laid across the earth. Even as distant as it was, the sound of the machine filled her chest and shook her body. Hot, spitting white steam poured out of the machine's stack, breathing heavy, chugging breaths as it pumped along the tracks. Sweating men riding atop the beast shoveled black coal into its burning belly. When the machine reached the cutting area, crews of men used sweating, frightened, chain-enslaved horses to drag thick cables up the mountainsides and hook them onto the fallen trees. Then a second massive, belching steam engine mounted on the back of the moving beast dragged the bodies of the trees toward it, like a long-legged spider slowly pulling in its prey. A dangling, steam-driven boom swung out over the ground, grabbed the logs with huge claws, and lifted them onto the rolling beast's back. The crews cut down the living, dragged in the dead, and stacked the carcasses one atop the other. She tried to imagine what they were doing with them all. She knew that they cut up the bodies of the trees to make their lairs and their tools and their weapons, their carriages and their toys and the cribs for their babies. But how many of the dayfolk could there be in the world for them to destroy an entire area of forest? A crew of men with shovels and wheelbarrows, spikes and hammers, approached the area where Willa was standing. They began digging and hammering away at the disturbed earth exposed by the explosions. They appeared to be laying steel tracks into a new area of the forest, establishing the course for the cutters to come with their machines. Where a rocky ridge or steep terrain thwarted their progress, they stacked small piles of red sticks and lit a long white vine on fire. They had blasted cavities into the sides of living mountains, broken apart large rock heads, and filled in the ravines of the river, flattening the mountainous land so that the black steam-belching machine could come. Some of the fires from the explosions still burned nearby, great plumes of black smoke rising up into the air. "That's what I saw from the mountain," she thought. Unable to take any more of the devastation into her mind, she pulled back into the forest and stumbled away. It felt like someone had ripped a hole in her heart. Saddened and disoriented, Willa found herself walking through an area of the forest that had been badly damaged by the recent explosion. The trunks of the trees were broken in half, their insides shattered, and their severed branches left to die on the forest floor. The bodies of dead birds lay strewn across the ground, blue jays and flycatchers, chickadees and woodpeckers, their feathers shredded and their necks broken. The carcass of a small red fox lay with its legs bent and its body twisted. She had come to the area of the destruction to help in any way she could, but it was too late. The fox's spirit was gone. The animals in this area were all dead. It left her feeling so hopeless,
so powerless to do anything.
The disturbed earth beneath her feet suddenly gave way. She lost her footing as the soil collapsed around her. She found herself sliding down into the ravine of the dammed-up river, jammed with crisscrossing trunks and scorched trees from the explosion. She grabbed frantically at the dirt around her, but she couldn't stop her fall. She was headed straight toward the churning rapids pouring through the logjam. Despite all that the humans had done, the river would not be stopped. Every muscle in her body bunched with panic. She was terrified that she'd get sucked into the powerful currents and pinned against a log. She lunged out, grabbed hold of a branch, and held on, clinging to the side of the ravine, just a few feet above the swirling water. That was when she saw it. It was one of the largest animals she had ever seen, but it looked so small with its body crushed beneath the trunk of a tree. It was completely exhausted and badly wounded, pinned half in and half out of the gushing water, its claws sunk deep into the bark of a tree, holding on with the last of its strength. It was seconds from drowning. The animal had jet-black fur and a long black tail, and its bright yellow eyes were staring straight at her. Chapter 33. The loose dirt crumbled beneath her feet as Willa plunged down the wall of the ravine toward the dark, churning current of the log-jammed river. In a flailing, desperate leap, she flung herself out at an exposed root and clung to it, and then willed the living root to intertwine around her wrists and hold her in place. She hung there now, just above the dangerous currents. And trapped just a few feet away from her, there was a female mountain lion, a panther, as black as night, unlike any she had ever seen before. She knew a predator like that could kill with a single swipe of her claws, but it didn't seem like the cat was going to attack, or was even able to. The panther's back was bent beneath the trunk of a fallen tree, and her bloody wounds looked excruciating. The cat's mouth was drawn up into a snarl, her whiskers trembling in pain. The panther growled repeatedly as she sunk her claws into the trunk she was pinned against and tried to pull herself free. Willa had overheard the homesteaders and the Cherokee telling stories around their campfires about the ghost of the forest, and her grandmother had described these mythical beasts to her as well. But she never thought she'd actually see one with her own eyes. She wanted to help the animal, but she was hanging on to the ravine wall by a spindly tree root, and she was terrified to go anywhere near the cat's sharp claws and deadly teeth. Panthers were one of the wildest, most vicious animals of the forest. She couldn't imagine how she could get any closer to her. As the powerful flow of the river gushed through the narrow chute of the ravine, it pushed the tangle of massive trees that had jammed up all around them, rocking it back and forth. She could hear the logjam creaking and groaning like it was going to give way at any moment. She had to get herself out of this ravine or she was going to get washed away when the river broke through. And she didn't have the strength to drag a panther out from under a fallen tree or lift a trunk from a panther's back. When she heard the loud, jeering call of the blue jays in the trees at the top of the ravine, she knew it wasn't just birdsong. It was a warning. A warning to her in particular. Some sort of new danger was approaching. When she focused her ears on the area above her, she heard voices and footsteps at the top of the ravine. They were coming her way. Expecting it to be a group of loggers with their axes, Willa pressed herself close to the wall and tried to blend, but dangling from the root, she couldn't stay still enough to hide herself very well. Then she saw them. It wasn't the loggers, but Farron. Gredick, Kydurg, Kiernan, and a band of other Yaters were coming, wielding not just the sticks they had before, but sharpened spears now, ready to kill the animals of the forest and bring their pelts back to the Pateran. the group of them were scavenging along the path of the destroyed ravine. They would soon discover the trapped panther, just as she had. Her grandmother had told her that one of the reasons that black panthers were considered magical was because they were so rare and elusive. Very few people had ever seen one. Willa knew that the panther's black fur pelt would be highly valuable, far more valuable than a wolf pelt, or coins, or silver jewelry, or anything else the Yaters might hope to get their hands on. When they saw the trapped and struggling panther, they would laugh with pleasure and chatter their teeth, then rush forward and stab her with their spears until she was dead.
Willa couldn't stand the thought of it.
When she looked again at the panther, she could see the desperation blazing in her yellow eyes, and she could see the panther heard the coming Yaters and understood the danger.
Willa's heart filled with a desperate sort of foolish courage. She willed the roots holding her in place to unfurl from her hands. Then she scrambled across the crumbling wall of the ravine to get closer to the panther.
The panther's heavy, laboring breaths moved great rushes of air in and out of her lungs. Her grinding claws gripped the bark of the tree trunk she was crushed against.
Willa thought she could make it over to the panther, but then the dirt beneath her feet and hands gave way.
She slid down the slope of the ravine and splashed into the river.
She reached out and grabbed the branches of the tree to keep from getting swept away, but the branches snapped in her hand as the rushing water pulled her under. She had been trying to help, but now she was caught in the same vortex of swirling current as the panther. They were going to drown together.
Then something large and alive brushed past her leg under the water. She yelped in fear and scrambled up onto the bank of the river as fast as she could. On the ridge above her, Gredek and Kaiderg were shouting. They'd spotted the panther. And they had spotted her.
Chapter 34.
As the Yaters on the ridge looked for a way down the wall of the ravine,
Willa knew she had to help the panther. But how? It seemed as if something other than just the fallen tree was preventing the cat from pulling herself free. But what was it?
The last thing Willa wanted to do was go back into the black, swirling water and encounter whatever was lurking down there. But she had no choice. She sucked in a deep breath of air and plunged in head first. She knew immediately that she shouldn't have done it. She could barely see through the cold murkiness of the water, and the undertow rushing between the logs was far more powerful than she expected. She tried to swim against it. She pumped her arms and kicked her legs and swam with all her strength. But it was useless. The current grabbed hold of her and slammed her against the submerged log, pinning her below the surface of the water. She couldn't swim free. She couldn't breathe. She was going to drown in seconds. Something brushed against her leg again. She reflexively squirmed away from it, but she couldn't even take a breath. She had to get to the surface. Then she felt dozens of tiny hands against her calves and her thighs. Other hands were pressing against her side, trying to turn her body in line with the rush of the current. A lean body swam between her legs, and another pushed against her ribs. She was being engulfed by furred attackers. Her mouth came up out of the water, and she sucked in a powerful, gasping breath. She pulled the air all the way in, letting it flow down into her grateful lungs, and grabbed one of the larger branches of the nearest tree so the current couldn't pull her away. A small, furred, dark face popped up out of the water in front of her. It had long whiskers, a little black nose, and dark, sparkling eyes. The river otter chattered at her, and then went back under the water. Suddenly the water was filled with otters swimming all around her, rubbing against her, holding her, pushing her with their hands, shoving her with their shoulders against her body. She could see that some of the otters had been burned by the flames when the explosion destroyed their holt, but they seemed determined to help her.
The same otter as before popped up in front of her again, scolding her with his chattering, as if he was irritated that she wasn't following his instructions. And then, finally, she understood. "But if I let go of this branch, I'm going to drown," she told the otter in the old language. But it was no use talking to him. "Let go, you foolish girl! Let go!" he seemed to be chattering. There was a loud crack of timber and a jolting movement as the logjam began to shift. More water started pouring through the logs. It was the river's will to keep moving, and the river was going to win. It was going to push and swirl and wash all these logs away, and her and the panther and the otters with them. Willa looked over at the trapped panther. She was barely hanging on. Her mouth was open, with its long, curved fangs, half in and half out of the water, and she was sinking deeper as the waters rose. Taking one final breath, and fully expecting the current to sweep her away to her death, Willa finally did what the otters wanted her to do. She let go of the branch. The otters immediately pushed in on her, twisting her body, showing her how to swim, how to dive, how to slip in between. "You're small like us," they seemed to be saying. "You can't fight the current. You can't swim against it. You swim with it. You slip through it. You spin, you dive, you fly. Use the water's power to propel you. You twist, you turn, gliding through as fast and slippery as a fish." With the otters pushing against her like she was one of their little pups, she was suddenly doing it. She was slipping through the water. The otter who had chattered at her on the surface led her deep into the dark, turbulent water beneath the tangle of submerged logs that were holding the panther's hind legs. The water was swirling red, filled with the panther's blood. And then she finally saw it. A steel trap had clamped onto the panther's back foot, and it could not escape. Chapter 35. Willa came up to the surface and took a gasp of air. "I'm sorry," she said, shaking her head to the panther. "I don't think I can get that trap off your foot." Glancing up toward the edge of the ravine, Willa saw the yaders making their way down through the loose gravel. The yaders were hollering as they came, brandishing their newly sharpened spears. The panther was being dragged under the water by the pull of the trap's chain. As her head sunk deeper and deeper, the panther opened her yellow eyes and looked at Willa. There was something about those eyes, something knowing, something pleading with her. But what could she do? It was a steel trap held down by a massive tree. In a moment of careless sympathy, Willa reached out with both her hands and touched the panther's face and head, as if to comfort her, to hold her there, to save her from being dragged under. But she knew it was no use. "I'm sorry," Willa cried out as the panther's head went all the way under the water. There was nothing she could do. The panther was gone. She was dead. Willa was sure of it. Then she saw her eyes. They were a foot under the water, but those yellow eyes were still open and they were staring up at her. She wasn't giving up. She was holding her breath. "You can do this," the eyes were telling her. With the otters chattering frantically and swimming all around her, Willa pulled in a lungful of air, then dove deep into the water. She swam down through the swirling darkness toward the steel trap. The otters swam with her, guiding her through the tangle of trunks and branches. She grabbed the jaws of the trap with her fingers and tried to pull it open, but the trap's spring was far too strong. She pushed and pried and pulled, but it was no use. Remembering how Lorkin and the other guard had tried to free the Padawan by pushing down on the levers on each side of the jaws, Willa grabbed the levers with her hands and pushed as hard as she could, but the levers didn't move at all. Hoping to use the muscles of her legs, Willa swam up through the tight, twisting tangle of submerged branches, positioned herself with her feet on the trap's levers, braced her back against a branch, and shoved her feet downward as hard as she could. But nothing happened. The levers didn't budge. The jaws didn't open. She just wasn't strong enough, or she didn't understand how the trap worked. She just couldn't do it. The panther yanked and pulled her trapped leg like she understood exactly what Willa was trying to do for her and was trying to help her do it. But it made no difference. The panther couldn't get free. Everything was trapped in the log jam. The trees, the branches, the cat. Then Willa realized that these weren't just old, dead sticks submerged beneath the water. The humans had toppled these trees into the river with their saws and their explosives. The trees were still alive. They were still struggling to survive. Their spirits were still strong. Willa swam down to the trap once more, but this time she didn't touch the cold metal pieces over which she had no sway. She put her hands on the surrounding branches and closed her eyes. She had practiced the kind of woodcraft she needed now when she was with her mamma. But she had been in a healthy forest at the time, with her mamma at her side, encouraging her, showing her the way. But now Willa was submerged in a log-jammed river. She couldn't breathe. She couldn't speak. She could barely hold herself in one place under the water. But she had to try. She gripped the branches, reached deep down into her sylvan heart, and awoke the spirits of the drowning trees. As she infused them with her will, the branches of the trees began to twist and turn. They moved like fast-growing vines, winding through the murky water, furling themselves into and around the metal jaws of the trap. This time, the limbs of the trees weren't moving of their own accord or because she'd asked them to. She was commanding them, controlling them, guiding them to grip the metal and pull. As she tightened her muscles and gritted her teeth, the branches slowly pulled the jaws of the trap apart. The panther pulled and pulled again, and then, finally, yanked her paw free. As the cat swam frantically toward the surface, her sharp claws raked across Willa's thigh, tearing a painfully deep scratch into her leg. With her leg bleeding, Willa swam upward toward the light. She broke the surface of the water and took a much-needed breath. But Kiernan loomed above her and drove the point of his spear right at her face. The panther burst out of the water with a snarling roar and slammed into the Yater with her claws, knocking him away. Gredek, Kyderg, and a dozen other Yaters charged forward, attacking with their spears. The panther looked at Willa to make sure she was safe. Those bright yellow eyes were staring right at her. "Yes, go now, go!" Willa screamed at the panther. "Run!" Wounded and exhausted, but still filled with startling power, the freed panther bound straight up the steep slope of the ravine, then leapt into the forest and disappeared. Willa felt a flush of happiness as the panther dashed to safety. As all the Yaters surrounded her at the edge of the river, Gredek said, "We've got you now, Willa. There's no place you can go." But as the Yaters came forward, she let herself fall back into the river, right into the most powerful current. It swept her away instantly, hurtling her downstream with tremendous speed. The spear boys might be able to catch a Farron girl, but they'd never catch an otter. Chapter 36. A long way downstream from the log jam and the Yaters, Willa crawled out of the river and collapsed to the ground, thankful to be out of the cold, rushing water. "The rocks are strong," she thought, But the river wins. It turns. It tumbles. It chooses the path. As she lay on the bank, the sun gave her its warmth, the earth gave her its stillness, and the living trees held sway over the world once more. She felt a sense of quiet and safety beginning to return, at least here, at least for a little while. But her mind burned with memories of the devastation she'd escaped behind her, the earth torn apart, and her mighty old friends crashing to the ground. She still felt the shake of the falling bodies in her bones, still heard the cracking limbs in her ears. The river had washed the sap from her hands, but the stench of the killing field lingered in her nose. It sickened her how the jagged-toothed steel blades had cut so savagely through the living trunks of the trees. She remembered how the loggers with the axes had cleaved the helpless branches, and the shouting men with the snapping whips had yanked at the leather-bound heads of the wild-eyed horses to drag the carcasses of the trees across the ground. The memories were aflame in her heart. But the worst memory of all were the birds. The hundreds of birds, their feathers torn and tattered, their wings twisted and broken, their bodies lying dead on the ground. A nest, a fox, a mantis, a fawn. A tree wasn't a tree. It was a world. And the men with the iron beasts were killing them by the thousands. She didn't understand the newcomers. What was in their souls to make them want to destroy the beauty and sustenance of the world in such a way? What kind of evil drove them? Whatever it was clear that they had come for one purpose, to cut down the forest and take the bodies of the trees back to where they came from. And they didn't care who or what they destroyed to do it. But as dark and frightening as the memories were, the forest around her now provided a warm, soft, green refuge, peaceful and serene. A gentle breeze flowed through the hemlocks, the birches, and the dogwood trees that grew along the river. And she could hear the buzzy murmur and tiny, claw-like feet of a nuthatch climbing up the bark of a nearby trunk. A small flock of chickadees whistled and cavorted in the branches above. It was as if the forest knew what she most needed at this moment, that the quiet whispers of the olden ways would soothe her woodland soul. When her mind turned to the panther, Willa smiled. Her heart swelled with pride. She had actually saved the life of a black panther. Her mamma would have been so pleased. And she would have wanted to hear all about it. In some ways, everything that had happened since she'd left Dead Hollow didn't feel real yet, like she hadn't truly experienced it. Not until she'd told her mamma all about it. Still thinking about her grandmother and her sister, Aliyu, long ago, Willa gathered golden seal and witch hazel leaves from nearby, then bound the wounds on her leg where the panther had scratched her. She knew the cat hadn't meant to hurt her. She'd just been trying to get to the surface. Even panthers had to breathe. As Willa worked on her leg, she remembered the cat's striking yellow eyes staring at her from beneath the surface of the water. "You can do this," the panther had been telling her. And she did do it. She just wished there had been more time. She could have helped the cat with her wounds, or sat with her for a little while, speaking with her in the old language the way she did with the wolves and the bears. But everything had happened so fast, and then she was gone. She kept wondering where the cat came from. Did she have a family of some kind, or was the panther on her own, like she was? She couldn't explain it, but she longed to see the cat again. She realized she was being foolish. That panther was a vicious predator,
Given half a chance, she would have probably torn her to pieces and eaten her for lunch.
But sitting there by the side of the river